The San Francisco Experience Podcast, brought to you by Jim Herlihy. Independent commentary from a Silicon Valley perspective for a global audience, featuring newsmakers, thought leaders, and authors. Season 25, Episode 14, Putin's Exiles, talking with Paul Starobin. Our guest today is Paul Starobin, former Moscow bureau chief for Business Week, a former contributing editor to The Atlantic, and a critically acclaimed author. He's a keen observer of Russia, her history, culture, and people. He joins us from his home in Cape Cod. Hello, Paul, and welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Paul, please take a few moments to tell us about yourself and your publisher, the Columbia Global Reports.
Yes, sure. Well, I'm a journalist and an author, and I've been at this for some decades. Let's just say I'm in my 60s now. I live on Cape Cod, and I've lived previously in Washington, D.C. and in Moscow, working as a journalist in both places. And this is my fourth book. And with Columbia Global Reports, they do a lot of these sort of mini books, often on very topical subjects like the one that we'll be talking about today, and often written as well by people with journalistic backgrounds, although not always.
Fascinating book. And of course, we'll launch into it in a minute. Russian President Vladimir Putin has been the leader of Russia for almost 25 years. You actually met him. He's up for re-election next month. And his greatest political opponent, Alexei Navalny, 47, died on February 16th. Without question, he was an exile from Russian society who captured the imagination and hearts of the Russian people, and you profiled him in your book. His sudden and shocking death in murky, suspicious circumstances set off alarm bells. President Biden met with his widow, Julia Navalny, and daughter here in San Francisco last week before imposing additional sanctions. Putin's war against Ukraine has forced almost 1 million Russians into exile. What is the Russian exile tradition, and why did you write this very timely and prescient book?
Well, the tradition itself goes back centuries. We can go back at least to the 19th century, and it's, I think, a function of Russia as a repressive society. To the extent that you have repression, as the repression tightens, you have exiles. You have people who are leaving the country, chiefly for political reasons, and they establish themselves somewhere abroad. Many of them, not all, get very politically active and seek to change Russia from without. And we saw that in the 19th century, figures like Alexander Herzen, who was for many reforms like the abolition of serfdom. We saw that with Lenin and Trotsky leading up to the Russian Revolution. They lived most of their active lives outside of Russia. And nowadays, what we're seeing, people who have left Russia under the control of Putin. Some of them began to trickle out before the all-out invasion of Ukraine by Russia in February of 2022, just about 2 years ago. A great many, and we think probably about as much as a million, left after the war, after the invasion, I should say, and for several reasons. For some, it was really just shock and revulsion at the war, very much a political issue, an issue of conscience. For others, it was a desire to escape conscription, a desire not to fight in, for war that they didn't believe in and that they didn't want to die for.
Now, in your book, you interview many of these exiles, and of course, it wasn't possible to go to Russia, but you interviewed them in neighboring countries like Georgia, Armenia, and of course, you also interviewed them in Western Europe, because these exiles are both in neighboring former Russian territories, as Soviet territories, I should say, and Western Europe. Give us a sense of the profile of some of these exiles.
Sure. And part of the motivation for writing the book, just to get to that, was that, I couldn't go to Russia for one thing. I was, I had a visa application with the foreign ministry, and it was never acted on, which I took as a no. And so as I thought about it, I thought, well, it's actually pretty interesting that all of these people have left Russia and are in exile. So why don't we look at those people and see how we can describe and assess, that community, the diaspora, we might say. So, for example, when I was in Yerevan, which is the capital of Armenia, I met a young woman by the name of Nastya, who was a She was from a village in northwestern Russia. She went to the medical institute in St. Petersburg. She stayed resolutely out of politics. Her mother told her, this is very common, you know, do not get involved in politics. It's not going to be good for you. She told me she would rather put a gun to her head than, you know, not get her medical degree. It was that serious. And in fact, several students were expelled from the school for participating in anti-Putin demonstrations. But the war brought her over the edge. I mean, it was too much for her. She left the country with her husband, who was a kind of a tech guy. And when I met her in Yerevan, she had kind of come out as an anti-Putin political activist. And when she did so the first time, you know, Russian state media was there in Yerevan to film the protest. Her mother saw her daughter, Nastya, on the footage, and called her up and screamed at her, you know, gave it to her, and accused her of being an enemy of the state, a paid tool of the anti-Putin opposition. I mean, you know, just really over the top stuff. And then when she calmed down, she the mother accepted that her daughter had taken this turn. But, you know, that kind of generational strife is also, I think, an important dimension to this. And, you know, so Nastya, you know, she was feeling terribly guilty about the people getting slaughtered in Ukraine. She was learning the Ukrainian language at a local center in Yerevan. And she told me she had hoped, you know, once this conflict stopped, finally, that she could go to Ukraine and help restore the country.
In her case, she was politically motivated, but you said that her husband was an IT specialist, and you also profiled a number of IT individuals and professional people mm-hmm. who left Russia and who didn't seem to be all that political, yet they did leave Russia, but they had portable skills, so they're able to get jobs as digital nomads, if you will, working in IT in Georgia or Armenia, Serbia, some mm-hmm. of the other countries. Give us a sense of some of those exiles who are not your traditional political exiles, but nevertheless felt either for fear of being conscripted into the Russian army or, you know, for some mild sense of outrage, left the country and then were able to become gainfully employed in their new host countries.
Yeah, I mean, I think the key is, it's right, it's not that same degree of sort of political, you know, activism. But nevertheless, I mean, the IT community, for example, in Moscow and St. Petersburg before the war was, you know, fairly, these are both Russia's most sort of liberal cities in terms of political orientation. And I think, like a lot of people in tech life everywhere, a kind of a libertarian kind of a disposition. I mean, maybe not so politically active, but believing in things like, you know, freedom of expression, and, you know, just the ability to create as they wanted to create without the heavy hand of the state. So I think in that sense, you know, just the fact that Putin has been tightening the screws steadily, really, since he's been in power, has not been, you know, something that the, you know, that the tech people have liked. The biggest single, or at least, you know, so-called Russia's Google Yandex, which was based in Moscow for a while. I did a profile of Arkady Volozh, who was the founder of Yandex, and he decamped to Israel. This is now well before the war, but a lot of the tech people also from Russia have gone to Israel. It's kind of a joke because they're not necessarily Jewish, even though, you know, Israel is Israel. There's just a huge Russian diaspora there. Yes. And many of them are very active, as I'm sure you know, in tech. Berlin is another place. I mean, there are a lot of nodes. And as you say, it's portable. So I don't know digital nomads in the sense that they're necessarily going from one place to another, but they have it's relatively easy for them to practice their livelihood wherever they happen to be.
Mm-hmm. And what about the TV station that had decamped to Latvia, was covering, you know, was beaming, I guess, their shows into Russia. And then Latvia became kind of uncomfortable with their coverage and they had to decamp for Amsterdam. Give us a sense of that dimension of exile.
Yeah. I mean, one of the other things that has happened during this Putin period, which again stretches way back, when he initially came into power, there were quite a number of, you know, independent, vibrant, strong journalistic news media outlets, publishing, all sorts of things that had cropped up in the 1990s, you know, when Boris Yeltsin was the president, a relatively liberal atmosphere. So Putin, you know, he began began tightening the screws, but still there were, you know, independent media in Russia, in Moscow, you know, during his time, and some really skilled and professional people. Mm-hmm. One of the stations that cropped up was called TV Rain, mm-hmm. Dosht. It was not founded as a explicitly anti-Putin station. It was an independent media, call it as we see it. But to call it as you see it at a time of increasing repression is going to bring you into conflict with the state and with the war, the all-out war, starting in February 2022, TV Rain, Dosht went into exile in Latvia. It literally became a criminal offense inside of Putin's Russia to call the war a war. The label is special military operation. Mm-hmm. So if you're a journalist, that's just impossible, those kinds of conditions. So TV Rain decamps to Riga, which is the capital of Latvia. Mm-hmm. Some other TV Rain people also are in the studio in Tbilisi in Georgia. And what happens is Latvia has its own history, as you can well imagine, as a former Soviet republic, of being in great tension with Russia, with Moscow, and now with Putin. TV Rain, in exile, still considered itself part of the greater Russian community. Mm-hmm. So when they referred to Russians back in Russia or the Russian army, they would use the pronoun we, because, you know, we are all part of this group. Mm-hmm. The Latvian authorities objected to that and other things. They thought it should be a they, and the situation became intolerable to the point that TV Rain got booted out of Latvia by the Latvian regulators, and now has reconstituted itself in Amsterdam, where they have a license which will be good for some number of years, so they continue to operate. But I think that's an interesting story, in part because I don't think a lot of attention has been paid to the kind of stresses and strains on the Russian exile community, many of whose members, and I think this is true of TV Rain, are doing some really good work.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also mentioned, you also visited Georgia, the capital, Tbilisi, where there's a very large Russian exile community. And you talked about the tension between the Russian exiles and the local native Georgian people. Give us a sense of that tension, because on the one hand, you have these Russians who've left Russia for a host of reasons, and they're able to reside in Georgia. But the Georgian people, again, because of past excesses by the old Soviet Union, the Georgian people have a not so fond memory of their time under the Soviet leadership, Soviet control. Give us a sense of how those Russian exiles have been able to live, coexist in Tbilisi, and how the Georgians have or haven't accepted them.
And the issue even goes back further before the Soviet time, because Georgia essentially became folded into imperial, czarist Russia. Mm-hmm. And like all of these places, was essentially St. Petersburg at that time was the imperial capital. So you learned Russian. Pushkin was considered to be kind of the cultural height, and whatever was in Georgian language and culture and so forth was considered inferior. So that's the kind of environment in which Georgia was growing up in. So come this war, Georgia is one of the easiest places among all places for Russians to flee to, and it's also relatively inexpensive. So you immediately had this fairly large presence of Russians in Tbilisi, the capital, where they were greeted by signs. I don't know if this is a family-oriented program, but let's just say the first letter was F and the last one was K, Russia. Also, signs like, and someone sent me a photograph of this on the wall, there were, good Russians, bad Russians, you're not welcome, go home, that kind of thing. When I showed up in Georgia, I speak some conversational Russian, and whenever I'm in these circumstances, it's like, oh yeah, great, I have a chance to try out a little bit of Russian.
Sure.
So in the morning, I approached the lady at the omelet blini station and began speaking. She said, I'm sorry, sir, I understand Russian, but I choose not to speak the language of my oppressor.
Oh.
So yeah, and there in the hotel, it was a nice hotel. It was filled mostly with Russian exiles. Mm-hmm. So, unable to speak Russian because nobody wanted to speak Russian with them. None of them really would have known Georgian. And so they're kind of struggling in their English, which some spoke better or others. And this is, I think, somewhat typical of the sort of stresses and strains, all kinds of practical difficulties you might imagine, access to your funds in Russia, ability to achieve residency, getting permits and employment and all that kind of stuff. So these are, you know, not easy conditions for these people to live in, basically, but preferable to having to go back to the motherland.
And what about the role of the church? Because for, of course, all during the Soviet Union period, of course, atheistic communism, we never really considered the Russian Orthodox Church as playing a significant role politically or leadership-wise in Russia. But that's changed now with Patriarch Kirill, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm fascinated by this particular subject and glad you asked me about it, because I think the Russian Orthodox Church and just religion in general is sort of misunderstood in Russia. I mean, from what we know, is that during the Soviet period, for example, there were the so-called KGB priests, where the state had basically completely co-opted whatever existed for the most part of religious life and religious institutions. Mm-hmm. So that changes after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the Orthodox Church kind of reconstitutes itself. But under Patriarch Kirill, who took, he's the head of the Moscow Patriarchy, which is the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, in effect, he formed a kind of alliance with politically with Putin. Mm-hmm. And he has completely gone over, to the war, to this notion of a greater Russia, which is what Putin is prosecuting, this sense that Ukraine itself does not have an independent identity, but is part of Russia. It used to be called in the Tsarist times, Little Russia, Mala Russia. And Putin is kind of reenacting that drama. It's really kind of a Tsarist drama more than a Soviet one, with this active assistance of the patriarch. But underneath that, and what's so interesting to me, is that there is pushback. There are dissidents in the church who disagree profoundly, with the patriarch and Putin on this, and who are pushing back. I met with a dissident Russian Orthodox priest in Batumi and his wife, because they're allowed to marry. Mm-hmm. And he has a deeply rooted spiritual and political disagreement with what is happening in Russia now, which is why he went into exile. So I think, that's not something you read a whole lot about, these days in the press, but I think it's important to pay attention to, because such people have connections mm-hmm. also with believers back in Russia. And, even Navalny, we haven't talked about Navalny, but one of his last speeches was in Moscow before he was sentenced was, "I am a Christian." He had a kind of a conversion. Mm-hmm. And since he died, there have been people who come out in Russia and who have honored his memory in that vein.
Let's move on to Navalny, because he, of course, you profile him towards the end of the book, and of course he died under suspicious circumstances on February 16th.
Yeah, highly suspicious.
Who was he? What role did he play? And of course, he was poisoned at some point. They thought it was Novichok, the nerve agent.
Right.
He left Russia, got medical care in Germany, recovered, but then he returned to Russia. Why on earth did he do that when he was the victim of Novichok? I mean,
Alexei Navalny, who died at the age of 47 years old, was, in the first instance, a political activist, an anti-corruption specialist in particular, who I think hit at a very much of a weak point, in the Putin era, as we might now call it, which is corruption. I think all Russians, even those Russians who have supported Putin, recognize that, corruption has been a very corrosive element of Russian society. So Navalny kind of rose to his prominence with an organization that did deep dive investigations into Russian corruption and published them, to great fanfare, as you can imagine. I mean, sometimes fairly shocking details, which of course also caught him the attention of the Kremlin and the anger of the Kremlin. So Navalny, sort of mid-career, was going into politics. He was seeking elected office, and that brought him into greater conflict and essentially became an intolerable situation from the Kremlin's perspective. Navalny was also spreading through Russia his organization. He was training people, sort of foot soldiers. I met one in Yerevan, actually, the capital of Armenia, who went into exile too. So he was unique in that respect in having a kind of Russia-wide organization. Then, as you say, there was an attempted assassination attempt. This happened in Siberia. It was before the all-out invasion. Navalny did not die. He was rushed to Germany. He recovered. His decision to go back to Germany, one of his close and longtime friends described that to me as a deep philosophical act on Navalny's part. It was an act of defiance at one level to say to Russia, to say to Putin in particular, and I think it had become quite personal, that, you know, no, you don't want me to do this, but I am going to do it. And I'll be more of an irritant to you inside of Russia than I would be outside of Russia. And I think that was the level at which he, you know, made that quite fateful decision. He would be, the screws tightened on him as well. He was convicted for one thing, he was convicted for another. When he died, he was in this frozen Arctic Circle, you know, region prison colony from which, you know, had he probably never would have been let out of.
So when he returned to Russia, he was put on trial. He was given this sentence. What was it? A 9-year sentence in this Arctic?
Initially. Right. But it got lengthened.
However, his organization left Russia is still operational in Vilnius, Lithuania, right?
Yes.
And that's headed up by Leonid Volkov and a young woman by the name of Yevchik. Could you talk to us about those two individuals and the role that they play in continuing the work of Navalny outside of Russia? And this is, we're really getting at the real tradition of exile work, political exile work taking place outside of the borders of Russia, but very much with a view to influence the politics internally of Russia.
Right. So, I mean, Navalny has always been number one very much. I mean, it's been his organization, and he is sort of the charismatic one that inspired all these followers. The two most important people in his organization have been Leonid Volkov, who has acted as his chief of staff, and Maria Pevchek, who has been the lead investigator. She's the one who's been responsible with Navalny when he was able to help with some of these really dramatic and shocking investigations they did into corruption. Their organization, the Anti-Corruption Foundation, exists, is headquartered in Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania. And like others in exile organizations with YouTube and all the tools of social media, they pump out a lot of stuff in the Russian language that is, anti-Putin, anti-war, continuing with these investigations and so forth, that goes directly back into Russia. YouTube is still open in Russia. A lot of people thought that Putin would close it, but so far he has not. Telegram platform that people have widespread access to. So a lot of this information goes right back into Russia, and that's part of what, I would call it sort of the information resistance tied to the political resistance. So the Navalny people will now continue to do that. And the twist is that Alexei's widow, Yulia, you mentioned at the top of the show, she said that she will assume leadership of this organization. She has not been really active in that capacity in the past. And so what I am hearing now is just kind of a question mark. Will she be able to fill that role? There are others in exile of a kind of political, with a mind towards being political leaders, or already with, influential platforms. So I think this is actually going to be contested, and we don't really know what the outcome is going to be.
I'm thinking of Eva Peron. Is Yulia Navalny potentially an Eva Peron where she can step into the shoes of her husband?
Yeah, and I just think it's too early to say. I was talking today with a young, very politically active exile. His name is Maxim Katz, who has a couple million followers, subscribers on YouTube. And he has not gotten along in the past with the Navalny organization. They've been, you know, we haven't really talked about this, but the whole exile political community has been kind of plagued, as such communities often are, by factions and infighting and personal rivalries and jealousies. So I think at this point, everyone kind of defers to Yulia because she has that stature as his widow. And, you know, it's a tremendously emotional and poignant thing. But the question is still whether she has the leadership skills that, you know, are needed. It can't just be that you're the widow, right? And so when you say Eva Peron, someone like that, we'll have to see if she can emerge in that role. I would think right now that there's something of a vacuum with the death, really the murder, I think we should say, of, you know, of Alexei, her husband.
Now, while President Biden was in San Francisco last week, he actually met with Yulia. She came to San Francisco to meet with the president. Her daughter, of course, attends Stanford, which is close to San Francisco. She was also at the meeting. And then, of course, at the end of the meeting, Biden announced that he was imposing additional sanctions on Russia. Talk to me about that meeting. Was that, is there any meaning to that? I mean, obviously there's a, it was a great photo op, but is there something, is there something more substantial to that meeting?
You know, I don't know. I think President Biden has perfected the, I don't mean this in any kind of a cynical way. I think he's kind of, he's had so much grief during his life that he is very comfortable with and able to comfort people who have lost, you know, experienced these kinds of, you know, sudden and shocking losses. And so that's one frame for that kind of a meeting. And more meaningfully, as you've said, you know, he's announced these sanctions. I'm not sure how well, I mean, you can have all of these sanctions, but Russia has not really been devastated by the sanctions. It's kind of managed, you know, in the global economy to kind of, you know, look that way, look the other way, and kind of get what it needs. So I'm not sure that the Russians have really suffered that much. And it's kind of politically symbolic for President Biden and European leaders to announce these sanctions, but I'm not sure how much they're going to hurt Russia. And the other thing I would say, and I don't think we've really seen much talk about this in the press in the West, is I think there needs to be kind of a policy towards the Russian exile community. At this point, it hasn't really existed. I mean, yeah, you have personal ties, you know, Yulia Navalny and so forth, but we haven't really seen much of a policy, a comprehensive way of thinking about these exiles, which I think are a political asset, you know, for the Russia, you know, for sort of the anti-Putin, anti-war cause.
Of course, President Putin is up for re-election next month.
Right.
Is what role can the Navalny organization play in that election, if any?
Well, the one thing that the exiles actually managed to agree on, including the Navalny people, was the promotion of the candidacy of the opposition politician in Moscow, in Russia, Boris Nadezhdin, whose last name is actually kind of a root word for hope in Russian. And no small achievement, they managed to get more than 100,000 signatures for his candidacy. Not a small thing, because Russians who wanted to, they basically had to show up at, you know, polling or registration stations, sign a piece of paper, say who they were, provide personal details to register themselves on behalf of the candidacy of Nadezhdin, which meant, of course, that they were exposed to Russian security services and so forth. So lots of brave people signed up for that, and that was an accomplishment. But then, not surprisingly, the election authorities kicked him, Nadezhdin, off the ballot, claiming that not enough of the signatures were valid. So I don't think there's a lot that they can do right now, the Navalny forces and the others, as far as this election is concerned. It's already determined. One thing that I am watching for, though, however, is the body of Alexei Navalny. Initially, the Russian authorities seemed determined not to relinquish the body to Alexei's mother, but she stood her ground and demanded it, and now I think we're going to see some kind of a funeral in Moscow, but Will it be open? Will it be closed? But that would be a real opportunity if there's going to be some kind of demonstration or, you know, public display of support for Navalny. And so we'll have to see how that goes.
Now, in the last couple of days, we've heard reports that right up until the moment of Navalny's death, that there had been attempts to swap Navalny, to do a spy swap.
Yes.
Which would have freed Navalny. Do you give any credence to those reports?
Yes, I spoke today with a very well-placed source with close contact with the Navalny organization who confirmed for me that Navalny was agreeable to such a swap. Mm. But why it didn't happen, I think we're still kind of looking into that. But one real possibility is that Putin himself changed his mind about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Paul, in the remaining few minutes of the podcast, will Navalny's death galvanize the exile community into an effective Putin political opposition in next month's election? Are all bets off?
So I think there are basically two reactions. I think there are people, probably many people, who are feeling somewhat demoralized because Navalny, having the stature he does, they took care of him, and it's just a kind of a shattering moment. But at the same time, I think there are many people who feel, exiles and others in Russia, who feel very angered by it and who are going to be prompted to work even harder against Putin. I expect that the exile movement will take a somewhat more militant cast. We could see internal violence, perhaps, in Russia, oriented against, you know, Putin, against the government. That tends to be the way things go when even the simplest forms of protest are not allowed. I mean, if you ran right now into a public square in Russia and you had a balloon in the blue and yellow colors of Ukraine or something, you would probably get arrested or stopped or something. I mean, there's just so little outlet for that sort of thing. So I think that makes people either give up or, you know, in some cases more determined. So it's kind of a crossroads moment is what I would say. And I think it's too soon to tell how it will come out.
Paul, what other projects are you working on at this time?
Well, I've kind of gotten obsessed with this one.
Yes.
I'm still, you know, all these things happen. You know, my book is published on January the 30th. And then, my goodness, 2 weeks later, Alexei Navalny, is the report of his death, his murder, is all over the news. And so, of course, I'm looking into that. I think I'll be writing more in this vein, I don't think another book on this subject, but on Russia. So that will probably take the form of magazine articles and things like that. And I also have my own podcast, if I could say.
Oh, of course.
America, yeah, America and Beyond on the New Books Network. And Russia is part of that, although it's more varied than that. And my other next project is to learn Italian with my wife, because we now have a little apartment in central Italy, in Umbria, and so we're learning Italian together.
Oh, that's very exciting. Very exciting.
Yeah.
And Paul, where can our listeners buy a copy of your book, Putin's Exile? And of course, once again, Columbia Global Reports is the publisher. Where can our listeners buy a copy of this excellent book?
I would go to the website for Columbia Global Reports, and you will be able to buy the book there.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And Paul, how can our listeners follow you and contact you?
I am on Facebook. I have a page there, which is largely about current events, so they could follow me there. They could check out the podcast, which again is American Beyond with Paul Starobin. I don't mind when people email me. If they want, they can at paul.starobin@gmail.com.
Very good. Well, listeners, you heard directly from Paul that you can actually reach out and email him directly. But of course, his website is available, as well as his podcast. And the title of the podcast, again, Paul, is America Beyond?
America and Beyond on the New Books Network.
Wonderful. Well, Paul, I'd like to thank you for joining us today. It's been a terrific conversation. It's a very timely conversation. You've given us background and history and the cultural sensitivity of someone who actually speaks the language, the Russian language, who's lived in Russia, and who, you know, you did the on-the-ground work of talking to these exiles. So thank you for sharing that experience with us.
Well, I appreciate you having me. It's been fun.
My pleasure. And for our listeners, today's episode is number 501. The podcast is brought to you by Apple, Spotify, Pandora, 18 platforms, with listeners across the United States and in 60 countries. FeedSpot has recognized us as a top 25 California news podcast, ranking us number 12. This has been the San Francisco Experience Podcast with Jim Herlihy, coming to you from San Francisco.